Hi everyone, I'm your host NG and welcome to the 62nd episode of the podcast. Sounds about right? Audiobooks help us understand the world. And on this episode, I was joined by Ariane Charvesi, author of the book Arguing for a Better World, How to Talk About the Issues That Divide Us. And this book arms you with the ability to build good arguments and find a path through conflict and confusion. Can you be racist to a white person? Does cancel culture exist? Is it ever okay to laugh at jokes that rely on racist, sexist, or homophobic stereotypes? Is it sexist to say men are trash? These questions tap into some of today's most divisive issues, and finding an answer can often lead to confusion and resentment. Arguing for a Better World cuts right to the heart of these tensions, with the aim of demonstrating the importance of rigorous definitions and distinctions, revealing the arguments that break the stalemates, and equipping listeners with the tools to identify and defend their positions. This book reveals and analyzes the power relations that shape our social world and offers powerful ways to challenge them. It was great to discuss the book of Ariane, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. How did you go about picking some of the topics you chose to discuss in the book, and why was it important for you to show your work in whilst discussing these topics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think there was any particularly rigorous method through which I chose the topics. It was more, what areas do I feel deserve greater thought? And so some of these were things that had been in the news a lot. So Black Lives Matter, men are trash, these slogans and what they mean and how they're interpreted and the kind of arguments that they generate. Cancel culture, again, in the news a lot. So there were things that I feel everyone seemed to be talking about, but most people were not talking about carefully. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of topics that fall into that category. But I chose those where I felt I already had some ideas that I wanted to express, or where I had some questions that I hadn't yet answered to my own satisfaction and wanted a chance to do that in writing. So that's how I chose the topics. And most of them have something to do with justice or language in some way. Those are the kind of themes that run through the book. Showing my working was important because I had become increasingly aware that there were lots of people who agreed with me on lots of these issues, lots who disagree as well, of course. And it feels important, I think, when two people agree on something, even when they agree on something, that they have some sense of why they agree. And that's how you avoid creating echo chambers, right? Because you actually have a fully reasoned rationale for why you think the way that you think on a particular issue. And so I had noticed lots of people agreed with me, but they weren't necessarily saying why. I wasn't necessarily saying why. And that felt a bit unhealthy, politically speaking. And so it felt very important to say, look, here's what I think about these issues and here's why I think this, right? And then to carefully lay out my reasoning, which might not, I mean, I'm sure you and I agree on many of these issues, but our reasoning is probably a bit different. And I think it's actually really healthy and important and productive to explore that. And then there's the people who disagree with me, right? And you and I probably disagree on some of these issues as well. And then it becomes even more important to see where our disagreement lies. And we'll only see that if we compare notes in terms of what our reasoning is. So that was the purpose of constructing the book around this idea that it's really important to make arguments for things, to make good arguments, to be able to justify what you think.
And how are the tools of philosophy useful in uncovering and confronting the ideologies you touch on in the book, Ariane?
Philosophy is obviously often thought of as quite abstract and academic and not especially useful maybe for everyday life and the sorts of disagreements that we have. In fact, I mean, all that philosophy is in some ways is thinking through certain topics very carefully, going right down to their assumptions, uncovering any kind of bits of faulty reasoning that might be there. And so the tools of philosophy really just ask us to be very rigorous in our analysis of something, to not be fooled by bits of faulty reasoning, to not be taken in by assumptions that are kind of standing in the way of us getting at something like the truth. And so what I try to do in the book is to use the method of argument, which is the central methodology of philosophy, right? And when I say the method of argument, I don't mean the method of kind of disagreeing with people and sort of having a shout about it, right? Which is an argument. I mean making your reasoning clear. So making your assumptions clear and then moving from those assumptions to a particular conclusion through a method of reasoning that most people, if they were thinking carefully, would agree was a sound method, right? So something that would move you from those assumptions to the conclusion without you making an error along the way. And so it's that methodology that I have used within the book.
So now I want to touch on some of the specific chapters within the book. And the one titled Has Political Correctness Gone Too Far? Why has the word woke now become synonymous with political correctness rather than being used for its original intended purpose?
Yeah, so the word woke, I mean, it's got an interesting history. It was first used in the United States and it initially seems to have been used within African-American populations to mean being especially sort of alert or vigilant in some way. And then over time came to be associated with a kind of awareness of or vigilance to racism and has then broadened out from there to be associated with a set of views that, you know, we might call kind of social justice views in some way. And political correctness has a slightly different history, but essentially the two have ended up meeting in the middle, right? And so they both now refer to uses of language in particular, which are carefully chosen to be attentive to social justice issues, right? And so they're used synonymously, essentially. And I think the thing with language is that we have to kind of accept what language does. And it is the case now that wokeness and political correctness essentially do just mean the same thing. And I think it's now more common for people to criticize wokeness than it is for them to criticize political correctness. Political correctness almost feels like the slightly more old-fashioned version of what's now called wokeness. And of course, the war on both, because at different political moments, there's been a sort of war on political correctness, now a war on wokeness. Certainly in the UK, that's how it's framed. But, you know, the same thing is happening in the US and elsewhere as well. And the idea here is that governments and other powerful people and institutions are very wary, very worried about people using this careful, attentive language. So it's quite a strange concern in some ways. It doesn't really make any sense when I put it that way, right? It's just people getting upset because the terminology through which we talk about disability or gender or any other axis of marginalization is becoming more fine-tuned, it's becoming more accurate. The people who are affected by marginalization are now more likely to be heard. And when they do speak up, they're quite likely to say that the words that have been used to describe them are not the correct words. But also any measures that are then taken as well to accommodate the needs of marginalized people are also being criticized under this sort of war on wokeness. And, you know, it's a very worrying turn. But yeah, I think political correctness and wokeness are essentially now treated as being entirely synonymous.
People tend to combat the political correctness argument by saying, oh, you know, freedom of speech, we should feel as though we can say what we want, how we want, etc., etc. How does freedom of speech often clash with other rights that we think are important to ourselves, Ariane?
Yeah, this is an important kind of tension here. So freedom of speech is obviously the right to express yourself. It is not an absolute right. It's never been an absolute right. Clearly, there are consequences if you speak in particular ways, right? And even if those ways are perfectly legal, there will be consequences, right? So even as simple as if you speak in particular ways about particular marginalized groups, then those people from those marginalized groups may choose not to have a social life with you, may choose not to be friends with you, right? And, you know, that isn't a violation of your freedom of speech, that your speech had those consequences, right? So freedom of speech clashes in all sorts of ways with other rights that we hold as well. So those who use their speech to marginalize others, in doing so, limit the possibilities for other people's lives, right? So a person who, so for example, suppose a teacher was to make sexist remarks within the classroom about the potential for girls to go on to be able to study science and maths at degree level. You know, that teacher in doing so would probably have the effect of, or their speech could have the effect of preventing girls within that classroom from pursuing particular career paths or academic interests, or at least feeling a bit weird about it in a way which might hold them back, right? So that would be an example of somebody speaking in a particular way, but it having very real consequences, very negative consequences for somebody else. So I think even on this very intuitive level, we can see that while we do in principle have the right to speak out as we wish and to express ourselves in any way we want, doing so is going to have an effect on other people, right? And if we can agree on that, then I think it's completely acceptable then to say that speech which has that effect, which limits the possibilities for other people, or which harms people, which humiliates people, is a problem. It's morally problematic, right? And it might not be that we can do much legally to prevent those forms of speech, so people can obviously lose jobs and things like this. It might be that we want to agree collectively that those forms of speech are not acceptable, right? And this is why it's so hard for me to understand why people get worked up about sort of political correctness, right? Political correctness is asking for greater consideration in our speech and in our behaviours towards one another. And that's not limiting our rights to express ourselves unless the ways in which we express ourselves are harming other people, right? And I don't think it's all that controversial. I think in most of these cases, they're pretty clear-cut cases of a particular utterance being harmful. And so these worries about sort of censorship, I'm yet to see a case where I really feel as though I'm worried. You know, in most cases, I just feel as though on some level that person must know that what they have said is harmful, and that forget what the law might say and forget what the government might think. You know, this is just a question of recognizing the humanity of others, right? And I just wish we could appeal to each other at that level, you know?
Another chapter I wanted to talk to you about is it sexist to say men are trash? How does saying not all men are trash trivialize or even derail the discussion?
So there's a whole chapter on men are trash as a slogan that's gone around on social media. And in some ways, I think it's probably the chapter that's perhaps most controversial. You know, the punchline is that I do think that men are trash is an acceptable slogan. And in arguing for that, I acknowledge that that's not going to sit well with everybody. The important point that I make in the chapter is that if we dig into the philosophy of language, then the generalization men are trash is a very specific kind of philosophical generalization. I won't have time to spell that out in full here, but I'll just give a couple of features of that argument. So, for example, so you and I, over the course of our lives, have had very many encounters with wasps while out and about, right? Especially in this season, where sometimes it feels like they're everywhere. And I've had two wasp stings in my life. And, you know, I know lots of people have never been stung by a wasp, yet I've encountered quite a lot of wasps, right? I still think it is appropriate, as my son, who's now coming up to one, so doesn't have any language at the moment, but as he gets older, I think it will be entirely appropriate for me to warn him about the potential for wasp stings, right? To be careful around wasps, okay? And this is despite the fact that he's going to encounter quite a lot of wasps, and really only a very, very small minority are going to pose any risk to him at all, okay? But a wasp sting is painful. Potentially you could have an allergic reaction. So it feels like an important thing to warn him about. And I think similar things can kind of be said in relation to men are trash, right? So men are trash is an important thing to say, or something along those lines. It doesn't have to be that statement. I picked that because that goes round online, right? But it could equally be something like masculinity is a problem, or, you know, there's any number of statements that I could make. The purpose of the statement really is to remind us all that there is something about masculinity that is a problem. And specifically, I suppose, if we could treat it as a warning and something about masculinity that in certain contexts is dangerous, okay? In order for that to be a reasonable statement to make, it does not have to be the case that every single man is trash or that every single man is dangerous, right? It just has to be the case that there is something about masculinity that leads to a sort of propensity towards trashness and danger that means that it's a reasonable thing for us to say, as with the wasps, right? And so in both cases, you could argue that, you know, it's not fair to wasps as a whole to say, beware of the wasps, wasps are dangerous, right? But I think the reality is that we don't know which wasps are dangerous, right? We don't know, you know, when you're out and about, you don't know which wasp is going to sting you of the very many there are. And you don't know at what point in time masculinity and the effects that it has on the behaviors of men is going to harm you, right? And this is because while it certainly isn't all men who are the problem, most men at some point are a problem. And sometimes there isn't much warning when a man who previously has a very good record for not being a problem suddenly does something very problematic, and that problematic behavior comes from his socialization as a man in a society that allows men to behave in very damaging ways and without consequences, right? And so in that chapter, I go through this in a great deal of detail and just defend that kind of a statement, what's called a generic generalization, which I explain fully in the chapter. It doesn't mean all men. And so these people who object, oh, you can't say men are trash, not all men are trash. Well, that's not what men are trash means, right? If it meant all men, then we would say all men are trash, and that would be a different statement. So there's some interesting philosophy there that I've put to work in that chapter. And I think it's one of those things where to follow the argument, you really do just have to read the whole chapter. So anyone who's listening in and thinking, no, I do not buy this, right? I do encourage you to read the chapter and then maybe come back to me and tell me which bits you disagree with.
Another chapter I want to talk to you about is the one titled, Who Should We Believe? And in the chapter, you mention how credibility has two ingredients, being knowledgeable and being trustworthy. Mm-hmm. But how do credibility deficits arise from stereotypes?
This is very important in light of sort of the Me Too movement, I think. So credibility deficits occur when we fail to believe a person or to treat their testimony, their attempts to tell us things about the world as they see it, with less credibility than we should, right? And the reason that we do that is because they belong to a particular social group that is marginalized, and part of that marginalization is not being believed, is not being seen as credible, okay? So there are lots of examples of this. So people of color, for example, are quite often disbelieved where they should be believed, okay? Working class people, people with a working class accent or speaking English with a non-British accent, right, are often believed less than they should be, so treated as being less credible than they should be. And women as well. So this is where the Me Too movement comes in, right? So women attempting to make themselves believed, so you know, the example with Me Too is around sexual harassment and sexual assault, and their testimony, their attempt to communicate to the world what has happened to them is not being believed. And it's not being believed because, as you say, of widespread stereotypes. And these stereotypes are, for example, stereotypes about how knowledgeable women are and how knowledgeable people of colour are, how knowledgeable working class people are, stereotypes about how honest people from these marginalised groups are as well. So there's a widespread belief that women lie, that women are dishonest, particularly that women lie about sexual harassment and assault in order to destroy the reputations of men, in particular powerful men, right? There's this very widespread idea about this. And the same is true of people of colour as well. So one of the cases that I discuss in this chapter is the case of Stephen Lawrence, a black teenager who was murdered in London in the 1990s. And that case was horrifically mismanaged by a racist police force. And one of the ways in which they mismanaged the case was failing to talk to and listen to Dwayne Brooks, Stephen Lawrence's best friend, who was at the scene when the murder took place and who was treated as though he was somehow responsible for or complicit in some trouble that the boys had got into. In fact, that wasn't true at all. And the reason that this was believed of him was because he was a young black man, right? So it's the stereotypes about being a young black man, about him being perhaps violent, about him being untrustworthy, an unreliable witness in some way. And, you know, this was one of many ways in which they completely, you know, messed up this case and also failed to treat Dwayne Brooks as the victim that he was, because he was also the victim of a racist attack, which ended with his friend dying. So these sorts of stereotypes mean that a person who should be a key eyewitness in a case is treated as somebody who is sort of irrelevant to it almost, right? And doesn't get the support that he needs as well. And the same is true with cases, as I say, of sexual harassment and assault when it comes to women, and in particular women of colour, where you've got the kind of compounding effect of race and gender. So stereotypes about women being dishonest and unreliable as kind of, you know, testifiers about the world around us. So stereotypes serve to discredit people. And it can be more specific than that as well. So there are specific stereotypes about women not being good at science, for example, which can make it especially difficult for women scientists to kind of flourish within the world of science. So, and or maths as well, where we see women as being kind of less able than men. There's no actual evidence for these beliefs. Like many stereotypes, these are just false, and they serve particular aims. But yes, the stereotypes are very closely linked to these credibility deficits, and these credibility deficits really mean that some people cannot participate fully in the exchange of knowledge, which is an absolutely key ingredient of human interaction. So really very serious consequences here. You know, being believed is an incredibly important part of being a person in a society.
Another question I wanted to ask you actually is, within the chapter, are we responsible for structural injustices? So is the idea of being mindful of our own carbon footprint a con?
It's not a con, I think. I mean, it was a con. Okay, so the history of the carbon footprint is that it was introduced by British Petroleum, so BP, oil company, on the advice of a PR agency that they employed when they realised that things were about to get tricky in terms of people pointing the finger at them for climate crisis, essentially. So they introduced this idea of a carbon footprint in order to get individuals to start thinking about their contribution to climate crisis, which would take the kind of spotlight off oil companies, make us all feel very guilty when, of course, our contributions are so small compared with oil companies. So it's a con in that sense, which is the most important sense, I suppose. It is just a con. It was a con, right? The reason I said it's not just a con is I do think it's important for us to think about our individual contributions to climate crisis, because there are ways in which some people are engaging in incredibly damaging choices, like, for example, driving SUVs in densely populated areas, which are very emitting. So on the one hand, it was developed in this very problematic way. On the other hand, perhaps it can guide us in some ways in kind of seeing how emissions are kind of unfairly distributed, because what the data shows us is that the wealthiest people really do have a much higher carbon footprint than the rest of us, right? So I think it might be useful in that way, but we mustn't lose sight of the fact that this was a tool used by a big corporate entity hoping to take the spotlight off their own damaging behaviours. And, you know, that chapter on are we responsible for structural injustice spends a lot of time thinking about climate crisis and worrying about the fact that we make these individual contributions, and those individual contributions on their own don't seem like very much. Added together, they're huge. Refraining from engaging in damaging acts. So, for example, so I buy all my clothes secondhand, right? So I don't contribute to the production of clothes, which is environmentally very costly. But it doesn't change anything. I'm under no illusion about that, right? A very, very damaging number of clothes still get made, right? Me refraining makes practically no difference. But it is nonetheless the case that the demand for those clothes in the marketplace from a large number of people is keeping that machine going of the clothes being made. So we almost have to think about these problems at two levels. First and foremost, we have to think about these problems at the level of the larger level of the structures that make these things possible. So clearly, one of the reasons why we all want to buy new clothes all the time is because of advertising. That's a huge part of it, right? And what the norms around kind of clothes being attractive for only one season and then not looking good anymore and all of this, you know. So the industry has created a certain appetite for consumption amongst us, right? So we need to tackle the things at the industry level, whether it be clothing or car production, meat production, any of these things. But I think we also, as individuals, need to be ready for that change to take place, right? And so we need to be kind of lobbying our governments. We need to be engaging in protest action where possible to try and bring about the large scale change we want. And then we also have to, as I say, be supportive of that change, right? So I think it is important that we think about how we live. And even if for most of us, we can't afford to live in any other way, right? So for most of us, we can't afford to make, a lot of people own a car because they've moved out to a suburb that's not very well served by public transport. And they moved there because it was cheaper. And so using public transport isn't an option for them to get to work, right? And so in many cases, we're constrained in the sorts of decisions that we can make. But I suppose what I'm saying is, such a person, when the opportunity comes for there to be better public transport and perhaps zoning of vehicles to mean that cars can't be driven in those areas, but there's really good public transport links, that they are supportive of such a move, right? Because that's the other element of it. So we've got to work on our own attitudes as well as bringing about the change at the big structural level at which it's actually going to make a difference, right? And that chapter kind of weaves between the two. It sort of thinks about what are our roles within the system. And fundamentally, I conclude that organized action is the way that we need to go. But at the same time, we also need to be thinking about our own actions and choices and whether they are universalizable. And as I say, to be ready for the sorts of changes that are definitely going to make for a better sort of world, right?
Lastly, did any of your opinions change whilst putting the book together? Or did you find when you was writing it, it was reinforcing a lot of the things that you believed prior?
That's a really nice question. And my views did change. I set out to write this book because I already had some ideas about some particular topics. So the Menatrash chapter, the chapter on Black Lives Matter, chapter on political correctness, I already had a pretty clear idea of what I thought, which isn't to say that that came to me all in one go. It was the work of many years of thinking about these issues, right? There were other chapters where my mind changed. And in fact, when I started writing the book, I didn't know what I thought about, or I wasn't sure what I thought about cancel culture. And I also wasn't sure what I thought about structural injustice and what we should do about it, right? And I left those two chapters to the end, and I kind of hoped that in writing I would figure out what I thought, which often happens to me. I'll often begin writing something, and the very process of writing is the process through which I realize the, you know, what I consider to be the correct view on that particular topic, right? So it's in doing the writing that my brain almost gets into gear and I start to really think carefully about the topic. And so I sort of hoped that I'd leave those chapters to the end, and then in writing them I would figure out what I think about cancel culture, figure out what I think we should do about structural injustice. I did not succeed on either front. I tried, and I wrote around the issue as much as I could in both cases. My mind did change. I think cancel culture in particular is extraordinarily complicated. It's used in lots of different ways. I think that lots of the time when we talk about cancel culture, it's often a right-wing prominent public figure making use of that term to complain about the consequences of them having said something really marginalizing or done something really problematic, right? So in most cases, I'm just not sympathetic. And I just think, come on, you're just, you know, this is a moral panic. It's been blown out of all proportion. You've done something unacceptable. You've got to face the consequences of it, right? But of course, that's not the only kind of setup for how cancel culture works. And cancel culture, I mean, and I'm using it in, as though it's a straightforward term. I spend quite a lot of time in the chapter kind of figuring out what we even mean by cancel culture. But I think, you know, there are many figures who have been cancelled, not because they have done something problematic, but because perhaps they've made some error and they haven't been given space to atone for that error. That can happen. For some people, somebody else has kind of gone after them in a particular way, right? And you get these kind of spats on between social media figures where this can happen. But also, there are some very high-profile cases of left-wing figures who have tried to speak out about racism, colonialism, and have been shut down and had their career pathways closed off because of that. And so this idea that cancel culture is something that affects people on the right because of sort of social justice warriors on the left, that's not how it goes. You know, it's more complicated than that. And I explore some of those cases in the chapter. But also the other thing to say is all this talk of cancel culture ignores the fact that most people can't really be cancelled because they never really had a platform to start with. They never really had a place from which to speak and be heard. And I think in some ways it would be much more interesting, and it's certainly much more important, to go back to the previous thing we were talking about and say, who actually gets heard? Who actually gets to be a public figure in the first place, right? Because being cancelled is kind of having a significant platform or set of opportunities reduced. So J.K. Rowling, for example, has had her significant platform ever so slightly reduced, right? And people often describe that as cancellation. But what about those people who just have no opportunity to speak whatsoever, right? Cancellation just doesn't apply to them, right? So I think there are some other discussions that we need to be having around this, and we need to ask why there's so much focus on that as a topic. So these are some of the very many complications that chapter explores, right? I ended up then taking the chapter in quite a different direction and thinking about forgiveness and thinking about how do we help one another to learn and to do better? Because I think, you know, that's got to be the primary aim. I do call people out when I think they've said things that are unacceptable. I am very open to being called out when I have said something that is unacceptable. But I think the appropriate and kind way to then go forward is to offer that person an opportunity to redeem themselves, to do better, to be readmitted into the world of people, right? Not to necessarily be excluded. And obviously, you know, we might need to deal with repeat offenders in a particular way. But for most people, it's a mistake that they make and they regret it. and there ought to be options for them doing better. And I think we're only going to get to a better sort of world by allowing people to get on board with us, you know, so that is important. So that chapter became very big and very complicated because I am not entirely sure how to answer these questions satisfactorily. And the same is true with the structural injustice chapter. And they're left at the end of the book, perhaps to be a bit more reflective. And I hope they're useful to people, perhaps to see what it looks like when you don't yet know what you think, right? Because it's also important to show you're working in those cases as well, you know? So yeah, my mind did change and things that I thought were more straightforward became more complicated. Things that I wasn't quite sure about at all, I managed to kind of work out what I thought. And I think writing's so powerful in that regard. And I always encourage my students to do this, but I would just encourage anyone to do it. If you're not sure what you think about something, whether it's like a political issue out there in the world, or whether it's just something that's going on in your life that you're struggling with. I mean, for me, the best thing to do is put pen to paper. And something magical happens in your brain and, you know, things start to fall into line and become clearer. And yeah, I feel like much more on an actual physical piece of paper than on a computer as well, which is where I did most of the note taking for the book. So it does make me a bit sad that pen and paper is sort of dying out a bit, because I think it has this, as I say, this almost magical quality, you know.
That was Ariane Charvesi, author of the book Arguing for a Better World, How to Talk About the Issues that Divide Us. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to Ariane for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next.